So this is the last of four presentations that I've given as a journalist in residence here at KITP, and I'd like to just I leave as many people do. I leave on Saturday. I'd just like to say thanks to KITP for a wonderful 3 months here, and much to my pleasure and honestly amazement, I was looking at some equations the other night that would have been largely incomprehensible to me 3 months ago, and the last thing I thought in coming here was that I would osmotically absorb a little bit of the physicist's sense of the world. So that's been a real pleasure and a real kind of deepening understanding for me how much physics and mathematics are a language in and of themselves. So this fourth talk was going to always be about language, but I'll tell you the event that really drove it home for me in terms of the great challenge we face in taking science from its original essence as research and discovery about the world into the public domain for a general audience. I went to Michael Friedman's talk on quantum topological approaches to quantum computing. And he began the talk by saying, this was just after the federal election, he began the talk by saying that David Gross had mentioned to him that this was for a general audience and to please keep it at a level that a general audience could understand. And he mentioned that in fact he had, and in his mind he had thought, well, who would be a general audience? And he thought about Sarah Palin. And so this is who he had thought he would present to. And I'm feeling, okay, great, you know, I'm going to be able to understand this. And lo and behold, 5 minutes into the talk, I was getting lost. I couldn't understand the language. And I thought, this is really humbling. I had thought, you know, that perhaps Sarah Palin and I were at least equals. But here I was falling far behind her intellectual grasp.
Thought you get lost listening to her.
Well, that's, yeah, maybe that's another way of looking at it. So, I want to talk about the process. No, okay. I want to talk that.
Unfortunately, as much as I love Michael, he lost a lot of
people. Oh yeah, and this isn't obviously a specific criticism. This is the grand challenge that we're all involved in. And so, you know, from algorithm to alliteration, to alliteration being two words that start with the same letter there. How do we make this journey? And I think one of the really interesting things is that by thinking about this translation process, it tells us a lot about language, linguistics. It tells us a lot about the process of science. I don't think I need, I guess we'll hear that again. I think it tells us a lot about ourselves. I think we can learn a lot about ourselves as individuals through this process. So to begin, to put it in the big picture and think about, well, what actually is the challenge? And I think what's interesting is that it's a very ancient one. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Tower of Babel, okay, which was at the time the largest engineering feat in the history of humanity, is the biblical origin of the concept of diverse languages. Because I think that out of this attempt to, in this case, build a tower to the heavens, there was an understanding that this would involve an enormous level of technical communication, and we can, I think, see down here in the corner, perhaps a general pointing to someone asking a question about the design. And we see that specialized knowledge begets specialized language. And if we fast forward a couple of millennia, we're still looking for the God particle, still trying to reach into the heavens. The machines are still breaking down. Perhaps not, there wasn't divine intervention in this case. But language...
How do you know?
Well, no, I'm just saying perhaps not divine intervention. We don't know, obviously. We'll leave that as an open question. But that here's this massive international project that involved enormous coordination of different languages, not only from all of the different sciences involved, but all of the languages, whether French or English or German or Chinese, in order to create this project. But I think that what's changed in the, it's been a challenge for millennia. But I think what's changed is that now science itself is a language. So science doesn't just discover, when we talk about science, the process of discovery, we're not just talking about discovering new things, but actually creating new words. And in my time here, whether it's with the quantum group or the Milky Way group or with the geneticists, those conversations are infused with words that, to anybody from an outsider, isn't going to understand. So we have quasars and pulsars and neutron stars, all of which are new words. If you go back, 120 years, those words didn't exist. And there's been an estimate that the average doctoral student will learn as many new words as if she or he were learning a foreign language. So in fact, by the time you earn your PhD in a science, you have learned the equivalent of a foreign language. And some of those languages are more or less like the language that you are embedded in, whether that's English or whatever other language. And some are quite different, as in, I think especially, mathematics and physics. And I think one of the key things is that these languages aren't just separate words. They embed a whole range of meaning and understanding about the world that's contained kind of culturally within the language. It's why two Canadians can say something to one another, and there's a meaning that perhaps someone from a different culture doesn't understand.
No way.
That's right. I think the other really critical aspect about science being a language, and I think this, if there's one kind of take-home message from this talk, this perhaps could be it, is something called the familiarity effect. And that is that as we learn a new language, we become skilled at that new language, we forget, or we even lose the ability to perceive that the way that we talk is different from anybody else, or that someone else isn't going to understand what we're saying. So of course, everybody knows what decoherence is, if you go to a quantum talk. Of course, everybody knows what anisotropic is, from a talk the other night. Everybody knows, what are some other words I was thinking of? Algorithms, Hamiltonians, Gaussians. These are words that are dropped around here as if, they're baby words. They're words that are just, that are the common parlance. But when we go out into the general public, okay, these aren't common words. But I think we're really blinded to that by being embedded in the language. So I think part of the challenge is, how then do we move out of that familiarity effect? So I think that's specific to the challenge of communicating science. But in the bigger picture of just communication, which is sharing information between, two or more people, there are some just general difficulties that I'd like to kind of put in a scientific context that face writers or scientists when we're talking to, kind of a more general audience. The first one, I think, is that, I was gonna ask you to just imagine for a second what an atom looks like. So in your head, imagine an atom. So obviously language is a proxy. It's you know, as I like to say here, it's a symbolic representation of something that exists in reality. And so in each of our heads, we can have a different image. So if one of us is giving a talk about atoms, and they say atom, and you've pictured an atom in your head now, is it this atom, which is basically kind of the Bohr type atom? Is it this atom, where we're thinking about subatomic structure? Is it this cool atom, where we're actually seeing quantum, you know, wave behavior? Or is it, yeah, a lot of atoms, or is it this atom, which I think for many people, when they think atom, they think in a larger cultural context. They're not even thinking science. And then we get into confusion. So here's an example. That is an example of how we can't even control what other people are thinking. You know, when we use a term, the complexity of it. And then now, one of the terms that's been used a lot in the last 3 months is the term a dark matter halo. So this is the material that surrounds what we can see in a galaxy. Now, the first time that, you know, I heard this talked about and I'm trying to perceive it three-dimensionally, I thought, now, can you see that? It's a little, I couldn't imagine, like, you know, when you go online and you look for images and you Google, like, halo, and this is some store in Britain that sells these for Christmas for dogs, I thought. But this is what, you know, a halo for most people is what an angel has around its head. It's largely a two-dimensional structure. But that's not what astrophysicists mean by a halo. They mean the blue here. So if this is the disk of a galaxy, for them a halo is a three-dimensional spherical structure. And when I've mentioned this dissonance for me, to many of them, it's like, oh, you know, suddenly this, you know, the familiar effect kind of pulls apart. But someone told me this comes from the historical use of the term halo in astronomy, and kind of gets so there's a whole different meaning to it. So the question, given, you know, the challenges in making this jump, given the inherent confusion, what's the way forward? Well, one option. Whoops, no, that there. Actually, I had one other challenge before I talk about the way forward, and let's make sure the sound is up here. And some of the challenges are far more culturally subtle, as in this one here. Can't hear it?
No.
Can you get the impression? Or does it not even come across? Well, the basis being that sometimes even gender issues get involved in whether we effectively communicate. So then the question is, what do we do? Well, earlier during my stay down in California, there was a talk about kind of the spiritual significance of astrophysics that I went to at a retreat called Mount Madonna, just south of California, just south of San Francisco. And I saw Baba Hari Bose, who is a Buddhist monk who has not spoken since 1951. Which is quite remarkable. He's lived in silence since 1951 and communicates only by writing on a little chalkboard, which I thought is not that far different than some physicists, perhaps, you know, who prefer to communicate in that way. But this is, I think this is an approach which says, you know, communication is so inherently, it takes us away from the truth to a certain extent, that I will remain in silence and explore the world that way. But if we're not going to do that, what is the road to communication? And I'd say there are three key aspects to focus on. And the first is start with the audience. And I think to some extent this can be counterintuitive, because generally when we give a talk, I think the first thought that sometimes goes through our heads is what are we going to talk about? What's the content of the presentation? When in fact, the success of the presentation is often based on starting with thinking about, well, who is the audience? And what are they looking for? What's the kind of language that they're going to understand? So part of the challenge with starting with the audience is I think there are actually three audiences that we are always talking to in public presentations. And that's what makes the public it hard to just think about the audience. The first one is the self. And this is me down at the James Joyce pub Saturday night, and they were selling some, they're trying to get rid of some vodka there, and these were the woman shilling the vodka. But I think that there's something called, you know, the mirror effect. We think the audience is going to be like us. So I think that my wife is going to look at this picture in just the same way that I am, okay, when I try to explain what was going on, right? Sorry? Yes. So there's that tendency to project our own understanding of the world onto our audience and think that they're going to see things the same way. So it comes back to the familiarity effect. Then we always have our peers. And I think particularly in science, one of the challenges is that in moving away from scientific technical language, which has been hard won for anyone who's earned their PhD, the language is associated with a level of intelligence and ability. So to use simpler or more general words is often seen, I mean, it's someone who's not as intelligent, you know, or to put it bluntly, stupid. Okay, so there's the concern is who, even if those other people aren't in the audience, there's that sense of, well, who else is listening, or how am I appearing to those people for whom it matters to me most, you know, my peers. And then finally, we have the actual audience, which might be in this case, you know, a group of children. So then how do we, let's see.
One of those your kids?
No. How do we then begin to think, okay, well, what kind of language am I going to use with the actual audience? And a question that I've come across, which I think is really interesting to think about, is what is the story my audience is living? And to give you an example, so I write for children, I write for adults, I write for, sometimes I'll do PR, so I know journalists are going to be reading it. And what I find, what my technique is for writing for these different audiences or preparing to talk to a different audience is to actually read that material, to try and get into someone else's head. So if I'm going to be writing, working on a kid's book that day, I'll read children's books. If I'm going to be, writing for a particular newspaper, I'll read that newspaper or that magazine in order to get a sense of the tone and the language that's used. And obviously, you know, that happens in writing for, writing for science journals. You kind of look at the tone. But what's interesting in most presentations or even for most, publications, there's very little actual, empirical testing of how much people understand. Most of this is something that's done almost as a collective exercise. So for journalists, it's, well, what are the editors think? You know, are the editors putting my stories on the front page? Well, if they're not, there's a very strong indication that either the story I'm choosing or the language I'm using isn't engaging. So there's a feedback process that that we get. And I think that by doing this, by thinking about what is the story my audience is living, it's what pushes us towards choosing relevant language. So if you think about it from the perspective of, I don't know, kids in grade six, you know, what is their life like? I mean, what are they doing? You know, what kind of TV shows are they watching? What kinds of things are they talking about? Those are the kind of, you know, questions that we can use to kind of get us in tune with the language that they might also be accustomed with. Now, one of the audiences that often comes up, and you say, well, if you're talking, you know, who are you talking to? And we'll say, the public. And I think this is one of the, this is a real tripping point in science popularization, because the public often becomes a stereotyped and bastardized kind of image of the public, and often, or of the public, of people, and often a very negative image. So, you know, during this last election, anybody know who this guy is?
Joe the Plumber.
Joe the Plumber, right. Kind of came to represent, you know, or was, people tried to have him represent the public. Obviously,
he's published now, right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe he is?
Yeah, that's what I call him.
Somebody's read a book for him.
Yeah, so...
about why he shouldn't venture into writing.
Okay. But, you know, I think what happens when we just kind of come up with this generic, the public, is it's often an attempt to avoid the complexity, I think, of what we're really involved with, which was a very multivariant, diverse group who are generally very interested in learning about science, but face all of these language hurdles. Okay, so that was the first one, in terms of getting the message out, focus on the audience. The second one I would say is that less is more. So what do I mean by that? I mean that, and this is, I think, one of these profound thoughts, at least for me, it is possible to give an audience all of the technical information and have them leave without understanding anything. This is one of the problems with the Challenger disaster. The engineers gave the upper management all of the information on the O-ring flexibility under certain temperatures, but none of the information really had meaning for the managers. It was given in numeric form and in little type and columns. They couldn't really get, you know, the risk involved in launching the shuttle when it had been sub-zero overnight. So I think of this as a noise-to-signal ratio, that every big word or TLA, anybody know what TLAs are?
Three-letter acronyms,
okay? It's an inverse square law. Right? Every technical word or TLA drops the level of comprehension in a general audience on a very steep slope. So it doesn't take many before the audience is, you know, most people in the audience are no longer with you. So three or four big words and most of the audience is, or big words, technical words that haven't been defined. So in fact, less can actually in the end be more.
Well, I don't think the analogy with the NASA's failures is really very sharp. It's more like with the NASA's more like with this financial failure. It isn't that management didn't know. The incentive structure is misaligned. The incentive for the managers is to have launches.
Hmm.
And they got away with it in the past, and they'll continue to get away with it, is their thinking. The fact that, you know, they didn't have an accent before, they didn't appreciate probability the way engineers do.
Hmm.
It's like with financial people. They chose, for their interest in their own careers, to ignore risk management, because those who pay attention will be out of a job. the last decade. It's the incentive structure. It isn't the same thing at all.
Different animal, eh?
It's totally different animal. But if you think about
the understanding of the Chalmers disaster, if you think about how people in the hearings, the key part of the hearings was Feynman's very simple demonstration, not all the technical jargon about the omen.
It wasn't that they didn't understand. They didn't want to.
Well, not them, but if you think about people just watching.
They could have dipped an O-ring in ice water, and they still would have said, he's an alarmist.
The people watching it understood that demonstration.
Oh, after the fact.
I guess that's what I'm saying.
Before the fact, they would have said, he's just an alarmist. He's another one of these scientists who, takes things out of context. Mm. It hasn't happened before. It wouldn't have any effect.
Yeah, I think that
5 years from now, the current financial issues will have been forgotten.
Mm.
And people will be doing something similar. It happens. Every 10 years, we have a financial crisis in the world. I mean, it's the incentive structure that's wrong. This is a different subject.
Yeah, slightly different. Sarah, did you want to mention something before I go on?
It's going to be economist in residence.
Yeah.
I'm not an economist, but
risk analyst.
I like this.
Right.
Well, I'd also like to say that it's interesting for incentive. People are very often asked, invited to give public lectures. I would be interested to know how many of them think of this as something as a great incentive to get their story across, and they're very excited about is this successful or not that I've shared my story, versus the number who say this is part of my obligation and I may not be very good at it, but I obviously should do this as part of my work, what I'm doing. I don't know how many have an incentive to really feel that they've communicated something clearly about their work. That's an unknown to me.
Hmm.
It's also the level of difficulty. It's far, far more difficult for a scientist to give a public lecture. I think Lincoln said it, he can give a 2-hour talk on any topic, but a 10-minute speech is going to take him 2 weeks to write.
I mean, the whole hour.
No, but that is clear. I mean, very challenging for us.
Right.
Hmm. Well, hopefully some of these will, the things they're going to get next to are so what can we do to make that presentation, hopefully both a meaningful experience, for scientists. I mean, that's really what I'm going to get into next, what I do on a daily basis, and that I think is just generally, what can be done in terms of popularizing science. So I call them comprehension boosters. How can you take the very technical information and package isn't the right word, or massage, but transform it, into a context that a more general audience can understand. So the first thing I add is some energy. So this first snippet was written by a scientist working with antibodies, written in Scientific American in 1980, when the magazine was much more written by working scientists for working scientists, and by 2000 it had been transformed into something that was written by professional writers, still for a broad audience, but just to get a sense of the language, when a foreign substance enters the body of a vertebrate animal or is injected into it, one aspect of the immune response is the secretion of plasma. So right into the heavy technical detail. And the point here is about the injection of action into the language. And what the science writer has done here, molecular guided missiles called monoclonal antibodies were poised to shoot down cancer and a host of other diseases until they crashed and burned. One other thing you'll see, I'd be interested to know if this is common in Europe as well as North America, but I kind of see it as perhaps being part of the military-industrial complex. Much of this action language tends towards military language, shooting things or blowing things up. You can find tons of examples of this. But turning language from being something quite passive into quite active. The other thing that writers will add, or that really helps popularize the language, and here it's you're not going to be able to hear the sound, so I won't play it, but is emotion. I don't know, anybody know Beaker from the Muppets? It's Beaker singing Feelings, and the song Feelings. And I just thought, you know, Beaker is this character who's often associated with the stiff scientist, and he's singing the song Feelings. But, you know, emotion has an enormous ability to carry meaning to people who might not otherwise be able to understand something. So the other big question is, what is the level of detail that I need to provide the audience? So you can think of this as a degree of resolution. What's the amount of resolution I need in order to actually get the data across that I want? Do I need a molecular level of detail, or do all I need to say is that this is Viagra, which is what Sinful, this is what this was, now in a slightly different context, and right? And this, so what's the level of detail that I need to give? Obviously in a doctor's office, this is more than is needed. Then the question is, how do I go from this level of detail to this level of detail? I like to think about it as reverse engineering language. And I find what often is very helpful for reverse engineering language, we were talking about this yesterday, is if you take your talk that you're going to give, sit down with your test audience, which might be your spouse or friend, and start, and whenever you get to a word that they don't understand, have them put up their hand. Right? See how far you get with the talk. And so here's an example of, this is a friend of mine back in Elmont who does medical communication, developed this little image, technical image. You can see there's a lot going on, but basically it can be resolved down to see spot run. You want to go back? So, right? Highly technical, but we reverse engineer this. And what I found so fascinating listening to the physicists' conversations here is it's a lot of brainstorming. I mean, these conversations are brainstorming, and I think that's the same process to reverse engineer. You know, you often have to sit down and say, okay, well, what exactly, let's just talk this through. What exactly is being said in more common language? Another, let's turn this up. Very powerful tool, metaphors and analogies and comparisons and examples. And these are really bridges from one way of thinking about something linguistically to another. The metaphors and analogies and comparisons provide a bridge. So we could start with completely gravitationally collapsed star or a black hole. Right, and that black hole captures a sense not just for folks outside the scientific community, but I think within the community. Now, one of the challenges I think is, well, how then do we come up with these comparisons and analogies if you're going to give talks? And what I found really interesting thinking about the examples, is I think you should get angry. You know, get angry when you're giving, or at least get passionate about it. Because if you look at the most famous ones, okay, think about Einstein saying it's just spooky action at a distance, which I think is beautiful for entanglement, right? Or Hoyle saying, oh, it's just a big bang. Or Schrodinger's cat, where he said, look, it's ridiculous. That's the whole idea of this cat that can be half alive and half dead at the same time. So these were people who were actually ridiculing the concept, and yet they came up with some very good comparisons and metaphors and analogies. And finally, so how do we make this language tasty for our audience? How do we engage them in the presentation? And I think the layers that we can see here is a good analogy in thinking about, we want to use a variety of language. Often this is in an educational context that we're giving talks to a broad public, where we do want to convey technical information. We do want to convey, we also want people to understand it. So when I'm writing a news story or a book for kids, there's the whole reason for doing it is to convey new information. So there has to be the beginning of movement of new words into the language. But by layering things, by making sure that I'm using analogies and metaphors that are carrying people along, that are providing that bridge, that I'm providing interesting examples, that there's action, that there's emotion, that I'm telling a story, that all of those things together can create language that is palatable for an audience. Thank you. That's it. Yeah, I'll leave it with the big cake there for dessert.
One of the biggest challenges here is a public lecture often contains a significant proportion of your peers as well as the general public audience. And well. The stated purpose of the talk is for the public. The tendency is to want to be able to include and keep your peers interested as well, and that takes an ability to elevate yourself up and down during the talk.
Mm. Well, I think totally what I meant by these.
What do you mean by elevate yourself?
The people I've seen who've been most successful at that have been people who aimed at the general audience, but they understood there were a great many peers in the audience too, with a lot of science in their background, so they were able to interject in the talk greater difficulty in the science for their peers from time to time and keep them engaged, but kept the general focus of the talk for the public audience. That's quite a hard balance to maintain.
It's a real challenge. The Museum of Natural History in New York, they came out with text for their exhibits that is three levels. So, one level, that level that children will be at is very, simple, larger text. A middle level, if you just want to walk by and get, kind of general information, and then a more technical kind of level. And I think that is a real skill of someone who can give, a great public talk, is to provide, let's call it, the higher level whipped cream for those who are more technically advanced, including the cherry, but still kind of, then come back and provide enough content that folks can be carried along who are new to the topic. Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed the Nobel Prize is now accompanied by two different descriptions of the work, one for lay people and one for people who are a little more scientifically diverse.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting listening to the Nobel speeches too. The differences in, that's usually for. I mean, historically, it's been for a very technical audience, and they're highly technical. Yeah.
So I had all sorts of that came up while you were speaking, but one thing that interested me, you were talking about incentives to speak and so on, and it made me think actually really yeah. Part of the problem for me is I have absolutely no incentive to do outreach or talk to the public. I do it out of a sense of duty, but I feel I get very little out of it because it doesn't, for me, represent the kind of interaction that made me go into science. There's basically no reward for me in it, partly because I feel I'm spending all my time explaining other people's work. It's nothing to do with me. I mean, if I explain how dark matter works, 99.9% of it is stuff other people have come up with. And it may not even be in my field of expertise at all, a lot of the background material. So that's one thing where I don't know what the answer to that problem is, but that's certainly one reason why I don't, But I was also thinking with the American Museum of Natural History, one I saw, the director, Neil deGrasse Tyson, do a public, it was part of a kind of, I think, a community course where people could come in and study astronomy. And one thing he was very good at, which I'd never seen before, and presumably you have to do if you're in New York, was he was controversial. You know, he didn't say, this is the picture, here's how it all works, it all agrees, and so on. He was very good at trying to include room for strong disagreement, for the audience disagreeing with the specialist he had brought in with, you know, and so on. So I was thinking maybe one way of doing that is to have, to try to always come up with more than one simple picture. Say to people, you know, here's a simple picture of how this works, and it works this way and that way. Oh, but wait, here's a different simple picture of how it works. And, you know, look, these two things are different, and we don't know which is the right.
I wouldn't do that. Because that, then you're allowed balance in the world to say
that
there's not probably global warming.
That's exactly where I feel, because I've had this argument about, you know, climate change a lot. That's exactly where I feel, for me, there are two types of people in the world. Exactly. There are scientists and politicians, and I'm not a politician, and I'm not interested in doing politics. I'm not interested in preaching to my audience. I'm interested in doing science with them, which for me is confrontational, and it's people disagreeing. And if you can't handle that, then, you know, I mean, I sort of, like, I feel the important thing is the intellectual thing. I want the audience to be going through the same process I am, which is a process of realizing this doesn't make sense. They haven't worked it all out. And I always feel you get pushed into the corner of, no, we have to turn this into a religion where we all agree, we all have one point of view, it's totally established, we're the experts, nobody can touch us. Otherwise, you know, Sarah Palin will come and run us over. And I sort of feel that that's going in the wrong direction. That's not our strength. You know, our strength is not being priests. It's saying anybody can get involved in this and engaged, and it's an ongoing thing. And if you're not interested in thinking, you know, don't bother joining in. But I don't know. That's obvious. People can disagree. So.
Tony, you're going to say something?
I understand your point. Did you say that you don't want to change your language, so you don't think it is necessary that people understand you in the audience?
No. It's necessary in everything. I'm just saying I don't enjoy it. I don't get anything out of it. I don't get anything out of explaining, you know, astrophysics to 10-year-olds. I do it out of a sense of duty. I recognize it needs to be done, but it's not rewarding for me, because for me the rewarding bit is the discussion, the conflict, and so on. So I want to move them closer to that. I don't want to, you know, the painting the picture doesn't, I don't find rewarding.
Is it different when you talk about your own work? I mean, if you were to talk about your own work to...
There again, I think it's the uncertainty and the conflict that's interesting. I mean, I find one way it works sometimes is at the human level, that if you describe your own work in terms of which group is fighting which other group, that's a very good way of engaging people, because they don't need to know the technical details. They just understand there's this big, well-funded group out there, and, you know, they beat you to this result, and now they're going to beat you to this other result, and you're in there, you know. I mean, it brings in the drama without, you know, in a sense, it could be any field of physics or anything, and you could bring in the same storyline.
Maybe so, but you have to distinguish between scientifically valid alternative points of view and superstitious nonsense.
Yeah. But I don't know. I there again, I kind of feel, for me, I feel there's a spectrum where you're never going to convince, you know, you're sort of preaching to the choir, that the rational people who go to public science talks and are really interested are going to be there already, and the irrational people who go to public science talks, I don't know whether it's possible to win them over with you know, clear reasoning. This is a totally explosive issue in climate change, where, you know, there are things like, there are people I know who can't go to certain conferences because the heckling gets to a point where it's a real risk for their security. I mean, we don't have that, but there are, I know in that field, there are people who, you know, they just know they can speak at this conference and they'll be safe. And they, if they speak at another conference, you know, they may be at risk at the level of, you know, violence from the audience or really serious harassment.
I think none of us are getting to that level here. So.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. Scott, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to make a tiny little comment, because you vaguely referred to my T-shirt.
This
sells another T-shirt. I just happened to see it on their website this morning. That might be more appropriate for you. It says, You've read my t-shirt. That's enough social interaction for today.
I need to look them up.
That's a Buddhist t-shirt, I think. The Buddhist monk t-shirt. Yeah, it's not, yeah. I said there were similarities.
A number of important things. The problem, I remember Feynman saying once, the problem isn't to how to, everybody's always talking about giving public lectures on modern physics. So the problem is, it's the guy in the checkout line who's reading his horoscope, that there's such a thing as a scientific method. That is where the issue really is for political impact, and I don't think anybody knows how to persuade someone who is superstitious that there's a different and more valid way of looking at the world.
Well, I think one of the things I found interesting is just when I arrived here, Martin Rees, I think he was the Astronomer Royal at the time, suggested that creation, well, that intelligent design be discussed along with evolution in science classes, not obviously as scientific content, but as an opportunity to talk about all of these issues. And I was reading one of Martin Rees's books last night, and it's just absolutely stunningly beautiful. I mean, the guy is, you know, it's a brilliant description of kind of astronomy. And he was just booed and kind of heckled out of his position on some national education group by, science teachers and evolutionary biologists, because this was seen as just an outrageous thing. And I think, I think it's just a tragedy, because having taught high school students who were, creationists at the time, were from a fundamentalist church, it's one of those things where I think, I'm trying not to get too many analogies, but, it's dialogue is the only, avenue other than, Baba Hari Das of, total silence. But, I mean, if you're actually going to engage people, it's not easy, it's not always pleasant, but I think it really, these kind of, techniques and using stories and, much of the misunderstanding in climate change, I think really comes from the fact, like I was driving through Arkansas a couple of years ago, I always listen to Christian radio in the South because I find it just such a cultural mind blast. And there was an author on who was talking about the ridiculousness of climate change, and he said, of course, this is such an arrogant human concept that only God can change the climate of the earth. I mean, people trying to people can't change the climate of the earth. And I think that that's partly related to a feeling or an understanding that as human beings, we just can't affect environmental change on a global scale. That's just like that's too big, it's too much for a lot of people, which comes back to understanding climatology and geology and atmospheric science. I mean, that's all grounded in a kind of basic understanding of the world that I think, more and better science education just kind of begins to chip away at. I mean, these are things I think that take unfortunately or fortunately, hundreds of years.
Just think you should lower the target a little bit when we're thinking about these public lectures. We're discussing here about changing their minds of the public to where the public whatever it is, but of scientific method, making them scientists. Instead, we're having a problem. It's just within 5 minutes, nobody has a clue on that audience of what you're talking about. That should be the first priority, where you can actually just nibble at the first layer. And then afterwards, once you've achieved that, then worry about bringing into context the thing of Feynman. There was the thing of Feynman that I think it was one of his videos that the high school you watch of describing how he attempted for all his life to end up going to one place to visit. He never got there. Mm-hmm. But it was, the whole idea was about the journey being more fun than the journey.
Right.
Which is the scientific idea of it. Mm. You know, there's ways to get the message across different ways, but the first priority should, you know, it's like me every day. We get all these unrealistic goals for everyday thing. I'm going to do these 10 things. I know for a fact that if I get one done, I'm very satisfied. But we always do that, so maybe one first.
Well, I think that the aspect about, you know, you made me think about this, you know, start, that what is the story my audience is living? I think going into a crowd, I mean, just to use the intelligent design as an example, going into a crowd where you've been invited to give a talk about evolution to a group of intelligent design, and not acknowledging their story, is just asking for people not to listen to you, right? It's, if you come in and just kind of, you know, give them the natural history view of the world, basically people turn off. You know, whereas if you come in and say, okay, you're starting, you know, there's an understanding that maybe that humans can affect change on a global scale. Maybe that, you know, or at least acknowledging where, you know, where your audience is starting. Right? Yeah.
And also why they should care. I mean, it's one thing to be able to describe something accurately and clearly so you can actually get your idea across of what you're working on and so the person can actually grasp that. But if it's still only because I've always wanted to do this since I was 7, how have you engaged them, you know, in terms of why should they care? Why is that interesting? You know, to a bigger, put it back into a bigger bubble somehow for them. Mm. Otherwise, it will simply be you describing something you wanted to do since you were 7, and you'll probably get one or two people who identify with that.
Right.
Who wanted to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back to the KITP public lecture series. I may be wrong about this, but I have a feeling that when they first started that they were more geared to the public, mm-hmm. and that the audience was not so full of KITP scientists. And I mean, so maybe if people started gearing the talks down, the scientists would stop coming, you know, that it sort of builds on itself, because it's knowing that they're there and you want to interest them, but they're not supposed to be here. This is a service of KITP to the community, you know, to the people interested in science and the community.
On the contrary, I think they should be there to learn how to give the public talk.
Well, for some of them, that's true.
That would be a good exercise. I've seen some amazing public talk, and I've enjoyed those public talks on how to give the public talk.
Right, I know.
But that is always coming back to, many people have mentioned, like in the presentation of Richard Feynman. So I've gone out and started reading, you know, his books. Well, there's a guy who could, scientists loved listening to him talk, and they're completely comprehensible talks to a lay person. Because he's talking about the discovery process in science, usually. He's talking about his own thing. And that's where, you know, it's interesting. Passion and energy, you know, the first thing, like putting action into language. I'm really interested in what you said about, you know, talking about other people's work as compared to your own. And it sounds like, you know, there's just not, you know, talking about something where where you don't feel passionate about it, I think is a really difficult challenge.
So back in, you know, 1860s, Thomas Huxley would give these talks, and they were packed in London. Tons and tons of people came from all over the spectrum. So today, when KITP does public lectures, university public lectures, who comes to these? And is it a broad enough audience?
I don't know. I don't want to speak for, I mean, it's not me, but...
I think, are you asking about who comes to KITP public lectures or who comes to public lectures generally?
Yeah, okay, both.
I'll give you a story. I used to be at the University of Michigan, where we started Saturday morning lecture series for the public. It was given, the lectures were postdocs at the Department of Physics, not faculty. And they worked pretty hard on these, and we would get 150 to 250 people from the community. Now, Ann Arbor is a
sophisticated community, but the people coming were not from the physics department. These are just people. And they would come on football Saturdays, which in Ann Arbor is an extraordinary achievement to pack an auditorium on a day when the Wolverines are playing at almost the same time is incredible. So that group is just the lay public that likes to look, listen, to learn about what's going on in science. They're probably college educated. Although occasionally a high school teacher would require their students to come because it fit into her curriculum. That initiative was inspired by the success of a similar thing at the University of Chicago. And I didn't think it worked in Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor's a little town. Chicago's a big city, but it worked.
Even here at Sundance, we're trying to, it depends, of course, in part who's speaking and what sort of interest it sparks. But you know, when Brian Green spoke at the Libero, we have a public lecture at the Libero, 670 seats at the Libero, and there were people in long lines outside waiting to try to get tickets. In fact, and it wasn't free. And some guy offered one of our postdocs $100 for his ticket because it wasn't any more available. So the postdoc figured he could listen to it online, and he made $100. There's tremendous interest in that.
Perhaps we could benefit here at KITP from a feedback mechanism from our public lecture series.
Well, sure, his name is known. I mean, when Hawking talked, it was at Campbell Hall, which is bigger,
Hawking is an interesting example. I mean, there's, you know, the language of the brief history of time. They came out with, you know, a briefer history of time. I don't know if anybody's seen that version, which is an interesting, if you go and compare those two, it's a study in this process. It's a study about, you know, putting a little more of Stephen Hawking into the book. I mean, physically with pictures of him, showing him in kind of superposition. It's using analogies, using, you know, more action language. But his public talks are very accessible. You know, you can listen to a lot or on online or YouTube. And he's, I think, you know, learned over the years how to make, you know, talks generally accessible. I think we have to abandon the room at some point. I don't know if there's another group coming in, but we're good. Well, I'm happy to talk more with anybody who wants to, you know, afterwards. I'll be around. But thank you for coming.